Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.
Welcome back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again for the first time in 2 weeks by Quint Kesnick. Quint, you were in Bristol for Selection Sunday, and now we are back in the saddle again, coming off of a wet and wild first round of the NCAA tournament. What a weekend it was. You were at two games. I was with you at Towson's just heartbreaking overtime loss to Maryland at home. But let's start in reverse order. We'll spend 4 minutes on each game and begin with the most recent, Notre Dame's 16-9 win over Johns Hopkins. For me, this one was all about the emergence and surprising contributions from two guys, Ryder Garnsey, who had been ineligible over the course of the entire regular season, the well-known Notre Dame star, and sophomore midfielder Morrison Meyer, who finished with 4 goals.
Yeah, Garnsey garnered a lot of attention based on his performance, and it was well-deserved. You know, you're academically ineligible for the entire regular season, and then all of a sudden you can jump in at the playoffs. Had a hat trick, and he'll provide some scoring options for Notre Dame, some flair, some creativity, some excitement. I thought the difference, Meyer and Garnsey, they had 7 goals. There's a depth of scoring there now all of a sudden that is going to be powerful and impactful. You know, Notre Dame continues to be an up-and-down team. They're 9-6. On their good days, they can play with anybody and beat anybody. On their bad days, they've been pretty woeful. Meanwhile, Hopkins, you know, I think the whispers will be that they didn't deserve to get in the tournament. You look at their last 3 playoff games, and it hasn't been kind to Petro and the Jays, being outscored 46-15 in their last 3 playoff games. So Notre Dame flexed their muscles early. I thought they appeared more athletic on ground balls, wing play. They shot the ball well from the outside, and they put Hopkins on the ropes right away in this game.
Hopkins scored first with Forrey Smith, and then the Fighting Irish reeled off 6 straight goals to end the first quarter. I thought it was an interesting decision that the Blue Jays staff changed up their goalie, replacing Ryan Darby with Jacob Jacquelone at the end of the first quarter. You mentioned the mid-range shooting. Brian Costabile had 2 goals in that stretch. What did you think of the decision to replace the goaltender?
I thought it was a little baffling considering that there were many opportunities along the way this year where Darby wasn't playing well, including early games against Towson and Loyola. They stuck with him. They stuck through him through a 2-save performance and a win over Maryland. So it was a little, it was different. You know, it was something that they'd been staying with him and allowing him to work through some of his struggles, but they made the move. And for a moment, it appeared like it was the right move, but Hopkins was just outmanned in that ball game. Joey Epstein played valiantly. I thought it was interesting the way Notre Dame was willing to switch. You know, no other team just operates defensively the way Notre Dame does. They got their best poles on Epstein and set a pick for him, and next thing you know, there's a shorty on him. And they consistently do that with a lot of matchups. So it'll be interesting to see how Duke, now playing Notre Dame for the third time, attacks that Notre Dame defense. If you remember game 1, that was the shift when they put Brad Smith to midfield. I think it caught the Irish off guard. Montgomery and Smith isolated, got good dodging angles and created some strong looks inside into the back post. Game 2 was different because Notre Dame bumped Jack Kielty up top, and Smith and Montgomery had less impact, and only C.J. Carpenter had a strong day for Duke. So, you know, Duke's attack will have to produce in this game. It'll be interesting to see what kind of dodging angles and matchups that Duke favors against this Irish defense.
You mentioned Epstein, attack contributing, depth of scoring, particularly with reference to Notre Dame. And for me, that was the story for Hopkins offensively. Epstein had 6 points. Forrey Smith had 3 goals. Cole Williams had 2-1. Kyle Maher had a goal. That's it. Only 4 guys got on the score sheet for the Blue Jays. And hard for me to know how much of that was a function of the moment and the role. Hard to know how much was Notre Dame's defensive priorities. You mentioned their willingness to let a star go off, and maybe that just has the cascading effect. But ultimately, the fact that the Blue Jays couldn't turn to anyone else to find production felt like a factor in the result, for sure.
Yeah, and I think going forward, you know, you're Notre Dame now. You got to face Duke again. These two teams have met in some epic games, whether it be in the ACC regular season, ACC tournament, NCAA tournament, NCAA finals. These two teams are titans, and this should be a great matchup.
And the last thing I'll mention is Charles Leonard had a really, really nice day at the Faceoff X for the Fighting Irish, won 17-29, and that's traditionally been a bugaboo for Notre Dame, and certainly as they continue to move forward, it'll be fascinating to watch. The last thing I'll mention is that keep in mind Notre Dame at the end of the 2018 regular season had a series of offensive outbursts and then was really limited in the first round of the NCAA tournament. That just, it's just lingering in the back of my head.
Yeah.
Particularly because they put up, you know, I think it was 17 against Duke in the ACC tournament last year, and then another big performance against Virginia, and then they put up 16 against Hopkins on Sunday, and you wonder if it means, maybe this team could put up 5 against Duke in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, exactly. No, they've been that way since March 9th, Terry. You look at their schedule, it's almost a perfect win-loss, win-loss, win-loss trend along the way, where it's a good effort followed by a bad effort. So, you know, I think they looked excellent in this home win in the rain, but they're a hard team to bank on from a week-to-week basis this year. You mentioned Charlie Leonard. He's a plus. They've never had that before. And then the play of Matt Schmidt, he was exceptional in that ACC tournament against against Duke. That was his best game of the year by far. And his performance is really meaningful if Notre Dame's going to keep advancing and keep moving forward.
Moving along, the Duke Blue Devils, 12. The Richmond Spiders, 11. Nakai Montgomery, the star in this game. For me, this was the game that I was able to see the least of coming on the heels of that game that I was covering. And for the Blue Devils, you know, survive and advance type moment. Richmond's certainly not afraid of this team. It was even early. Duke rattled off a series of consecutive goals, and then the Spiders fought back but weren't able to get enough.
Yeah, three benefits for me of doing these home games. You know, I get to stay in my workout routine and eat my normal food, and then I was getting home able to watch so many of these games live on TV. And, you know, I missed the first part of the Duke game. They were good early they were slow early and poor late. But in between the second and third quarters is where they won that game. You know, being outscored 4-0 in the fourth quarter and this game looking a lot closer than it probably needed to be is a concern. Nakai Montgomery was excellent with 5 points. He's proven to be a playoff player. Seems to get better as the year goes on. A concern for Duke is the depth of scoring that we thought would be there at the beginning of the year. It wasn't in this game. They only got one goal and one assist from their bench. And the attack, you know, they just don't have a strong behind-the-goal presence and an attack dodger who demands any kind of double teams or defensive recognition.
For Richmond, a really nice season once again. You know, obviously the SoCon championship game proving to be a kind of, you know, just a bellwether for this program. But, you know, for me, Tate Gallagher is a guy to watch heading into next season. He finished this game with 4 goals and just a really nice step-down shooter, creator, can do a lot with the ball in his stick.
Yeah, Richmond's Richmond. You know, I think Dan Chamati's proven now in, 6 years? They've made, 3 NCAA tournaments? I think that's accurate.
Yep.
You know, they're just a consistent player in that league. They improve. They get better with losses during the year, and they seem to rise come tournament time, come conference tournament time. The question now being, what's the next step? You know, what is the next step for that program? Does it come down to a star player? Does it come down to bigger, stronger, faster guys that can compete with the ACC, Big Ten, and Ivies? I'm not quite sure, but certainly they're, as terms of a mid-major, they're about as consistent as it gets right now in the landscape.
Moving along, the only unseeded team to advance to the quarterfinals, the Maryland Terrapins, 14-13 victors over Towson at Johnny United Stadium on Sunday afternoon. This was a game that it looked like both teams had in control in the fourth quarter. Maryland went up just fewer than 6 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. A 2-goal sequence in about 30 seconds. First, Maryland ties it to make it 10-10. Alex Woodall wins the faceoff. Towson calls timeout. Immediately, they turn the ball over. Jared Bernhardt starts the quick restart deep in the Towson defensive end, goes straight to the goal. There's some question as to whether or not he stepped into the crease before executing his dive, made it 11-10, and then off the subsequent faceoff win, Bubba Fairman with a nice split dodge to his left hand, made it 12-10, really felt like Maryland was in control. But no, Towson responded, three straight goals, including one with a minute 50 to go. Maryland calls timeout. Coming off of the subsequent faceoff win, off of violation, Towson chooses to run down the shot clock. At this point, it's 13-12. Brendan Sunday gets a look late in the shot clock. The ball goes wide. Maryland gets the ball back with 23 seconds left. It was a frenetic clear. Ball ended up in Kyle Long's stick. He was on the corner wing, and it was amazing the patience he demonstrated watching multiple cutters run through. Finally found Jared Bernhardt sweeping to his right hand, catch and shoot, 3.7 seconds left, tie ball game, overtime. I don't know how you felt going into overtime, but it felt like it was going to take a miracle for Towson to win, because to give up a game-tying goal in that situation, it just felt so deflating. Yet, the Tigers win the opening faceoff, turn the ball over. At the top of the box, Roman Pugliese comes up with the ground ball, leads it the other way, and once again, it's Kyle Long, this time finding Lewis Dubik for the catch-and-shoot finish in the middle of the crease. Ball game, Maryland moves on to take on Virginia in the second round.
Hey, we could talk about this game for the entire length of the podcast, Terry. It was that type of game. You know, I replay that last minute in my head, you know, and you try to second-guess these coaches, and Sean Nadelin played the percentages. The only thing I would say is two things, and one I neglected to mention in the broadcast. The first would be, you know, I think Sunday should push towards the goal a little more aggressively with that last shot. Draw a penalty, get a reset, and the game's over. Okay, so they were a little passive there. Then they back up in their ride. You know, is that time to turn up the heat on the ride a little, maybe, and roll the dice and pseudo 10-man? Not sure. But then defensively, with less than 10 seconds to go, all the rules of engagement are thrown out the window. And I've mentioned this on other broadcasts, but that's an opportunity for a defensive player, when your man cuts the middle, to tackle him, to hold his arms, to grab his stick, to foul him flagrantly, because they're going to throw a flag, the ball's going to be loose, and the time's going to run out. And so when you're up by a goal in that scenario, you do have the liberties with under 10 seconds to go to play outside the rules and to be illegal, because they can't put time back on the clock. And so that's the only thing defensively. That's a point for players of all ages. Yeah, I know it's unsportsmanlike. I know it's not part of the rules, but I think that's the right play there, Terry, to tackle that cutter.
One of the interesting things that I learned in post-game, John Tillman really lamented the decision, went back and forth on whether or not to press out. They chose to play it straight up and let Towson run the clock all the way down to that 23-second mark. He mentioned that he had burned the timeout with the earlier in the sequence, coming off of that, into that face-off with a minute 50 to go, earlier in the fourth quarter. What was interesting about that, you know, so basically what I'm saying is that he wanted to call a timeout there and set up a what are we going to do in this situation moment. I really thought that with about 20 seconds left in the shot clock, about 45 seconds left in the game, Towson should have called timeout to set up a final look that would have potentially given them a two-goal lead heading into that under 80-second scenario. And it turns out that from Maryland's coaching staff perspective, that would have been bailing them out, because it would have given them an opportunity to reset. So, you know, we know that Towson traditionally has been pretty slow to call their timeouts, and that was a sequence in which, you know, they went into overtime with one left, and I'm not certain, you know, you point out what they could have done in terms of their ride, what they could have done in terms of the last 10 seconds defensively. I wonder what they could have done with about 35, 40 seconds left on the clock offensively in order to set up a better shot.
You know, it reminded me of the 2009 final between Syracuse and Cornell. and the way that game ended on a Cornell failed clear that led to that Syracuse miraculous tying goal. You know, if you play those scenarios over again, how many times does Towson win that game out of 20, let's say? You know, how many times can Maryland chalk up that game tying goal the way they did? You know, and people took shots, quite honestly, at Jared Bernhardt's inclusion in the Tuaritan list. They said his points weren't good enough. He's not the highest scorer on his team. Watch that game. Watch the end of that game. And what he did with that incredible jumping goal where he basically jumped the diameter of the crease, and that's 6 yards. I mean, he was in the air for 4 to 5 yards there. And then the game tying goal, you know, in quick action, it looks like just a catch and shoot. Watch it again. Kobe Smith's stick is in his hands. He's fading away from the goal, almost no look. And he manages to put that between, you know, Canto's stick and his ear. So a great play, timely plays define his efforts this year. The game winner against Ohio State, the fourth quarter against Towson. So I think he really verified and stamped his inclusion into that five-man list.
You mentioned Kobe Smith. I want to give him a shout out. I was really impressed by the way he played, particularly in the first 3.5 quarters, 6-on-6. I mean, you don't need to sell me on how good Jared Bernhardt is, and he did a really nice job.
I think Kobe's a future first-team All-American. You look at the matchups that he was covering this year from top to bottom, whether it be Spencer, Teat, Ethan Walker. You know, you look at Towson's schedule, and he's drawn some tough assignments and done terrifically well. He's only a sophomore, and he'll continue to grow. He's a great player.
Two more performances I want to spotlight. Maryland goaltender Danny Dolan finished with 15 saves, and Towson faceoff specialist Alex Woodall. Not certain whether he was going to play coming off of a quote-unquote upper body injury. Hadn't played since April 20th, won 22 of 31 faceoffs, picked up 14 ground balls, and for me, it was the time, the speed with which he got out of the scrum versus a trio of Maryland really good faceoff specialists, starting with Justin Shockey, including Austin Henningsen, and then Wesley Janik, the senior, made an appearance and probably had the best success over the course of the day.
Yeah, Janik's a scrapper. You know, guys like Janik and Lewis Dubik, you know, kind of define the Maryland program. I give a little shout out to Thomas O'Connell, who started in this game for Jack Welding. You know, you break down Maryland tape over the last couple of weeks, and on, you know, my notes, I had, you know, a close defense surrendering a lot of goals. They made the change. O'Connell's a former midfielder who switched to shorty, who now is a close defender. And it's a Maryland defense. In their last 6 games, they've given up a lot of goals. Okay, doubled it, 13 Penn State, 12 to Michigan, 16 and 12 to Hopkins, now 13 to Towson. So Maryland's defense is not what it used to be. This is a team with a legacy, though. 7 of 8 championship weekends. They've got guys on the team that won the title. I think that experience showed up at crunch time. And now Kyle Long, he was the difference maker. You know, Maryland doesn't get many points from their bench, but they were running long with that first group more often. He finished with 4 assists in this game, okay, and has a lot of momentum. And he's a tough cover, and he adds a wrinkle to this offense that they haven't had this year.
In the first game of the day, the number one seed Penn State Nittany Lions took on UMBC winners of the midweek playing game. This one, a lot of these games over the course of the weekend can really start and end with their face-off dominance. Penn State emerged 25-10 victors over the Retrievers. Junior Gerard Arcieri won 25 of 27 face-off attempts. And when you look at UMBC's offensive efficiency on a possession-based model, it really does point to how much of a possession advantage Penn State got, because the Retrievers were able to score goals led by Ryan Frawley. And at the other end, I mean, no surprise, Grant Ament, 3 goals and 5 assists. Mack O'Keefe, 6 goals. Jack Kelly, 6 goals. If the Nittany Lions get the ball, they are a buzzsaw, but there is a lot to be impressed by in terms of what the Retrievers were able to do when they got the ball to their end of the field.
Yeah, and maybe that offers hope for teams playing Penn State. You know, clearly the defense is not the strong part of that team. They play a fast, aggressive style where they're trying to get turnovers. They're trying to get resolution early in possessions. But they're 15-1, Penn State, okay? They shot the ball 58% against UMBC. 58%. For the year, Terry, they're 44%. I can't remember a number from a team in the past that's close to that. I mean, usually 35% is the number we're saying, wow, they shoot it great. They're 44% on the season, okay? Their extra man is unstoppable. The depth of scoring, you know, six guys with 35 or more points. Nine players have double-digit goals. It's you know, Jack Kelly, I'm watching tape of this game yesterday. This kid's running through people like they're standing still. Amenton O'Keefe, and they just keep throwing waves at you, whether it's Malone or Spillane. There's so much to like about this offense. It's almost historical in nature in terms of goals per game, shooting efficiency. You know, it's fun to watch.
It is historical, and it will. You know, if this team goes on to win the national championship, it'll be one of those situations in which, you know, I'm not trying to say that people haven't noticed how good Penn State is, but I am among many folks who I think are saying, give me a little bit of slack. Like, I just want to see it, and we're seeing it, and I'm starting to believe, but there's still a little bit of doubt. There's still a little bit of, all right, well, they played they were the one seed. They earned the right to play the winner of the playing game, but in so doing, they played the weakest team in the 16-team field. So, you know,
yeah.
A 25-10 report, there's still something to see is what I'm saying.
Spin it forward now. If you're dealing with Pat Spencer and Loyola, okay, a team that can score, a team that is pretty good at the faceoff X, Loyola is, yep. Not great, a team whose defense has been kind of shaky at times this year against high quality competition, a team that has to switch from man to zone. Penn State's not the type of team I want to put a zone defense against personally. I mean, they have a great extra man that usually correlates into great zone offense. So this is going to be really interesting to see how Charlie Toomey, Loyola's coach, comes up with a defensive strategy. You know, do they take some air out of the ball, or does Loyola say, "Nah, we're going to run with you guys. We think we can score. We got Spencer and company." This is going to be fascinating, I think, in terms of pace and style of play and offensive efficiency and then possessions.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of places that we can dissect this one. One that you didn't just mention, I anticipate that Jacob Stover is going to put together a performance better than the seven saves that UMBC got combined out of their goaltenders on Sunday.
Yeah, Loyola's plus 10 in that category. You know, they shoot 33%. Opponents are only shooting 23%. Stover's a proven commodity. They really pack it in and give up the outside shots. So, you know, Stover's ability against Mac O'Keefe from mid to outside range will be essential in this game. I thought he was great late in the game. You know, he finished up with 10 saves against 3 goals against. I think it was late in that game. And put his foot down at a time that he needed to. A strong, strong senior performance in his last game on his home field. The biggest question, though, that emerges, and something we've talked about all year, you follow Loyola, you know, midfield scoring. Duffy, Swindell, McGovern, Brown, and Wigley. They've got to keep up with Penn State's depth of scoring. Can they do it?
In Saturday's nightcap, the Virginia Cavaliers 19-10 victors over Robert Morris. The Romo came into this game after starting the season 1-7 on an 8-game win streak, but ultimately Virginia just one of those games where they continuously extended the lead. You know, got it to 1, then got it to 3, then got it to 5. Outcome was never really in doubt. I think, you know, for me, 6 goals from Mikey Herring kind of demonstrates that contribution, unexpected contribution that we saw out of Notre Dame on Sunday night. And then equivalently, you know, on the other end, Ryan Conrad with 5 goals. Just that was an impressive showing from a guy who hadn't been a consistent goal scorer over the course of the season. And then Matt Moore, 2-7, and he's fully converted into an attackman and showed me that, you know, he's a playmaker. He's a guy that is going to find the open man. And I thought it put a lot of pressure on the Colonials' defense.
3 things stood out. I was fairly impressed with Virginia and have been recently. And you hit on the Herring day, but this is a team that's pretty reliant on their stars. You know, they're not deep in terms of depth of scoring, and so we'll see what they can get out of that bunch. But defensively, they're just so much more organized now and structured than they were earlier in the year. When you think back to that loss in week one against Loyola, even the first third of the season, you know, they had those head scratching moments, like, what are they doing defensively? But I think they found an identity there. But what really stands out, Terry, the effort plays, the diving for loose balls, the scrapping, the riding tenacity. This is a team that is clearly bought into Lars Tiffany, and they have a mentality of like hustle, and they're celebrating those plays. We saw it in the ACC semifinals and then the ACC final against Notre Dame. And that's a thing of beauty because that translates. You know, you can take that anywhere, whether it's a quarterfinal, a semi, or a final. Like that identity of the hustle team is so important, and Virginia's become that, and it's cool to watch because you know they're just bringing the effort on all the little plays.
The guy I want to mention forever, Morris, is Tyson Gibson, a midfielder who finished with 2 goals and 5 assists. I thought, you know, he was the star offensive player coming into the game, and despite an organized defensive effort, he was able to find his looks against the Cavalier defense, and warrants a mention for the NEC champs.
Romo, you know, the Canadian influence, you watch him. They got great sticks. I mean, I'm watching the first quarter. I'm like, wow, this team can really pass the ball. Great stick work, you know. And so it was a good test, I thought, for Virginia. And Romo, you know, the way they turned their season around was miraculous. I went back and I looked at it. You know, 1-7 to 8 in a row, scoring tons of goals. And you can see why. High skill level.
I mentioned face-off dominance being key to results in games this weekend. That included Penn's 13-8 victory over Army in Franklin Field on Saturday afternoon. Kyle Gallagher went 22 of 25 facing off against the Black Knights, who came in as one of the weakest teams facing off nationally.
Yeah, this game, look, Penn holds serve at home in a game that I know that it was a challenge for them. You know, they haven't won a playoff game in forever. They're coming off a weekend in the Ivy Leagues up at New York where they were tested in 2 games. They put a lot of emotional energy in that. So I give them credit for hitting the reset button and coming back and getting the win at home. Simon Mathias, so consistent, so strong, so balanced in his game. And then Rosner, you know, he was the difference maker because Handley, all of a sudden, the freshman, is in a little bit of a shooting slump. He's 1 for his last 14 after shooting, you know, 40% for the year, let's say. So he's in a little shooting slump right now, but they got production from Rosner on that second midfield. I was not as encouraged from this Penn effort. Again, it's one game. You don't want to judge a team on one game, but the 23 turnovers and the sloppy stick work is something that's going to have to be cleaned up. I mean, you just watch it, and they were botching some passes that need to be crisp and clean.
One sign of encouragement for me, they did a really nice job taking away Brendan Nickdern, Army's number one option, the freshman attackman, held scoreless. And, you know, whether it was Mark Ivancic or an overall defensive effort, I thought that was something that the Quakers could be encouraged
by. Yeah. Ivancic, under the radar a bit, perhaps. I don't know. You know, you think about the way Chris Fake struggled against Dan Bucaro, and, you know, is Ivancic the best defender this year in the Ivy League? Because every time I've turned him on, he's done a wonderful job. He's sturdy. He's built really low to the ground, but his footwork is great and choppy. And it looks like you could create separation against him, but he closes the door and he's super strong. He's been really impressive. And Penn's, you know, BJ Farrar is a wicked transition threat at the pole for Penn. But I thought their shorties in person were big, strong, fast, tough, play their angles well. That was what I walked away with the Ivy League championship, those 2 games at Columbia, saying, you know, Penn's got shorties that are athletes, and now they've proven that they can play with top-tier teams.
You mentioned Yale. They like Penn, and Penn State rode an incredible face-off performance to a 19-16 victory over Georgetown. T.D. Erlin won 31 of 35 and picked up 29 ground balls. But the Hoyas I watched pretty much all of the weekend, and I will say, no team in terms of their fight, their collective vision, their unwillingness to give up impressed me as much as Georgetown, and it was really led by Dan Caro, who put up 8 goals and an assist.
8 goals on 18 shots. I cannot remember the last time a player took 18 shots. And, you know, the Hoyas spotted him the head start, and that really comes down to the difference. And Yale's shown the ability this year to put a game away late. This is a Yale team that's playing really fast. I mean, 54 shots per game. They took 50 shots in this game. They're scoring more than 15 goals, okay? A little under the radar of what Penn State's doing offensively, but Yale's offense is pretty cool. You know, the high volume shot selection can be questioned at times. You know, they take some weak angle shots. The good news for them is usually they're throwing the ball wide of the goal, so they're not turnover shots. And then depth of scoring, you know, whether it's Brandow or Rooney coming off the bench, the fourth attack slot, they have a bunch of middies. You know, Kotler caught fire. They got 8 players with more than 20 points, so they're not reliant on a Tevlin or a Ty or a Danagelis to do it all. There's some comfort there knowing that they have kind of a deep group of middies. Now, the defense is eye-opening poor when you think about it on a possession-based model against Georgetown. And Yale, that's kind of back-to-back games. I thought in the Ivy Final, their slide decisions were poor. You know, are we going? Are we staying? What's our recoveries looking like? And they're going to have to clean that up.
Yeah, and it's weird because when I watched this game from an individual matchup and personnel standpoint, it didn't feel like they were making a ton of mistakes, especially early. So hard for me to judge what percentage of Georgetown's efficacy was a function of we got our backs against the wall, we're going to dive bomb at the goal because that's what it takes in the situation that we're in. Meanwhile, defensively for Yale, they're not going to play with as much urgency. They're not going to create as much friction, the word that they like to use, because they know that they have the luxury of this either big lead or possession margin over the course of the game. And so I guess my question is, it's unclear to me how much of Georgetown's 16-goal performance is real as in terms of a reflection of Yale's defense and how much of it is a function of the way in which the game played out.
Yeah, and spinning it forward, again, Penn's beaten Yale twice this year, 3 overtimes at Franklin Field, and then 12-11 in the Ivy Championship. This is, the third time. These teams know each other so well. Kyle Gallagher has been the catalyst here to, keep the TD Erlin face-off matchup manageable or even winning that matchup in the Ivies. And let's see what TD's got up his sleeve. I'm not convinced he's at 100%. He looks like he's a little banged up. I don't know what the deal is. These Fogos take a beating. So we'll see what he looks like physically, and we'll see what he looks like tactically, because Gallagher's super quick off the whistle with that pinch and pop. And the thing, Kyle has been dominant this year, except when he violates. So really important to keep your eye on his early face-off violations, if they do exist in the first and third quarters, and then how that impacts his ability to pinch and pop out the front, because he is just great off the whistle, okay? And sometimes we've seen in quarterfinals, semis, and finals, when the crowd size in these big stadiums, when it's really loud, that can hurt that type of Fogo. So this will be just fascinating to watch that matchup and who wins the whistle.
In the first game of the weekend, the Loyola Greyhounds 15, Syracuse Orange 13 from the Ridley Athletic Complex. You know, this is one of, well, heading into the fourth quarter, it looked like the Orange were in good shape, and then Loyola reeled off a string of goals. You know, it would be overstating it to say that it was the Pat Spencer show. In my opinion, he was 3 goals and 6 assists. Awesome as usual. But I felt like it was the contributions of their complementary scorers that help determine the outcome of the game.
Well, it starts with faceoffs, because going in, we thought this would be a high-scoring game that would, you know, come down to possessions, and Loyola suddenly was starting to win more of the possessions in the second half after being really run off the field in the first half from a ground ball standpoint. almost a 2-to-1 margin.
It looked like they just weren't going to show up. They didn't have nearly as much energy. They weren't contesting. They weren't playing as fast. And Syracuse was wild.
They were a step late. They were a step late, especially on the wings with Fernandez and Brett Kennedy winning all those contested ground balls. I thought Loyola was getting pushed around. So they made some subtle adjustments, and their effort level, their compete level just raised up. And the extra man scored two critical goals to start their run. Okay, this was an offense that wasn't operating full efficiency. They seemed to lose a little rhythm and flow. And then you put on the free throw line, so to speak, and they found that rhythm with those two EMO goals. And then that carried over to their 6-on-6 sets. And just a brutal ending for a Syracuse team that had shown flashes late in the season of being a contender. The Orange, their comebacks, their failure to close games, they are just great TV. I hate to say it, but they are. And I'm not sure where they go. I think Syracuse is going to be really strong next year, but Loyola got it done at home. Goaltending, possessions, and Spencer. It's pretty simple, right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the energy level, and I thought that, to your point, Bailey Savio was the bellwether, and the way in which he continued to ratchet that up over the course of the game was infectious. And it wasn't just about the face-off X for me. Guys like John Raley and Paul Vallant, in terms of their ability to compete on contested ground balls in the defensive end, improved over the course of the game. Syracuse is really good and really slippery off the ground at the attack, and early on, they won all of those battles, but as the game drew on, Loyola was able to get some extra possessions to complement what they were getting off the face-off X, and ultimately that's why they reeled off 7 straight goals in the fourth quarter.
Good point about Raley. That was the best he has played this year. Remember, he was a late-season starter for Alex Johnson when he dislocated his elbow. They've since brought Johnson back at the pole to be he's a really good transition player and strong on ground balls to give McNulty some rest. But Loyola's ability to change defenses is going to be a storyline. You know, again, man and zone, they've got some deficiencies defensively. I thought late in the game, though, guys dug in. Cam Wires actually got better as this game went on in terms of holding his matchup and creating some turnovers. So this will be fascinating for Charlie Toomey, how he can muck it up, and does he have a strategy to deal with Penn State's offense?
You mentioned where Syracuse goes from here, and Patrick McCue made an interesting point when we were talking about this game as it was going on. He referred to it being a matchup of a number one man offense, that being Loyola, keyed by Pat Spencer, versus a number five man offense, that being Syracuse, referring to the best midfielder who was guarded by a short stick being the guy who keyed the offense. And for me, putting it that way was really illuminating, because number one, that's what we've seen out of Syracuse for most of this decade. You know, maybe at the height of Kevin Rice's productivity, they transitioned into a number one man offense. But aside from that, you know, they've been a team that's really scored goals through matchups. And when you look at the box score, not all these guys were, you know, first or second line midfielders matched up against a short stick, but they had Brendan Curry, 2 goals, 0 assists. Peter Dirth, 1 goal, 0 assists. Pat Carlin, 1 goal, 0 assists. Jacob Buttermore, 1 goal, 0 assists. Brett Kennedy, David Lipka. Bradley Voigt was limited to 2 assists. That was probably one of the biggest factors in terms of the outcome of the game. Nate Solomon, who, except for when Steven Rafus has played at his best over the last 2 years, probably comes closest to a number one attackman for the Orange, had 2 and 2. But when you look at scoring and it's distributed that way, you can spin it one of two directions. Number one, you know, they're manufacturing goals in different ways, and they've got a number of different guys that can contribute. But you can spin it negatively and say that it means that they don't have a Pat Spencer-type player that can take things over. And when you look at the recruiting pipeline, I'm not sure there's a guy in the foreseeable future that's going to fill that role. And I think that's one of the sources of frustration that's most substantial for Syracuse fans. And the question is, will it resolve itself? Is there a number 22 in the future?
Yeah.
And it's not just about the pressure of the jersey. It's about the style and identity of the team and the program. And I think it's a reasonable question. It's unreasonable to ask whether Syracuse can win this way. They have proven that they can be a perennial NCAA tournament contender, even a quarterfinal contender, even a Final Four contender. But that's not enough for this team's fan base. And the question I have is, do they need to be a number one man offense in order to win a national championship? And if so, who's that number one going to be?
That's, you know, that's a million-dollar question, because that number 22 ended up playing for the Albany Great Danes for a bunch of years, and Lyle Thompson and Connor Fields, and that number 22 may be playing for Loyola right now, and Chase Scanlon. Those are typical upstate New York recruits that they always pulled in, and they're not doing that right now with the, with those signature recruits. And so the whispers at Syracuse and Johns Hopkins, and the unhappiness that, that is now this, this modern lacrosse landscape will the noise, the whispers will turn into noise, quite honestly, you know. But I think people in central New York and Baltimore are a little perturbed, and so we'll see how this this is handled during the offseason.
And we'll end with a brief comment on the quarterfinals. Two matchups of teams playing each other for the third time in Penn versus Yale and Notre Dame versus Duke. And then two teams, two matchups that are particularly interesting for their newness. Penn State versus Loyola, featuring the top two offenses by adjusted efficiency. And Maryland versus Virginia, the first time these two teams have met since the Terrapins left the ACC to join the Big Ten. Quint, which one are you most looking forward to?
Wow.
Tough one, right?
I don't look at it that way. You know, I kind of look at my week and I'll map it out. I'll swing by Loyola practice probably Tuesday or Wednesday. Thursday afternoon to travel day. Friday we're at Hofstra all day watching practices, talking to coaches and players. So I look forward to that. And then we make the drive up to Hartford. We'll do those coaches on the phone earlier in the week. So I've seen every team in person multiple times. No, other than Penn State was a remote production. So I got a little catching up to do in terms of film, but otherwise I'm locked and loaded. Like if they play these games on Tuesday, my boards are built and I'm ready to go. So now it's just fun. Just watching more tape, talking to players, going to coaches and trying to refine what should be a great quarterfinal round. I mean, these are really eight good teams, a lot of national storylines here. And I hope the fans turn out at Hofstra and then Rentschler Field, which is kind of a dry run for the national championship game. When is that, 2020 or 2021?
It is 21. Yes, 21, yeah. Too. It's also Preakness week. I hope you get a sunrise run in.
Perhaps Thursday morning. We'll see. We'll see what the weather and we'll see what the familial responsibilities are here. But I like to swing by there in the morning, usually 6:30 to about 8:30, and just smell the horses for a while, it's a cast of thousands over there. It's fun. It's fairly close to where I live, so it's something I look forward to once a year.
Well, Quint, that'll do it for the Quick Restart Podcast. As always, appreciate you joining us. Appreciate the listenership. If you like what you hear, tell a friend, leave a rating and a review, and we'll be back next week with a recap of the quarterfinals.
Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3, poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.